Welcome to The Lob by These Football Times, the home of long-form storytelling online. Let us loop you through the ages of football. So sit back, learn, and enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to another episode of The Lob Podcast. I'm your host today, John Townsend, football coach, long-term writer for These Football Times, and today I am not only lucky but also honored to be interviewing four different gentlemen, all talking about football, football coaching, analytics in football, and current projects they're working on. I have Jed Davies, technical consultant for Magnus Pearson, head coach of Estonia; Kev Nicholson, U21 manager of Cardiff City, also the youngest English coach to hold the UEFA Pro license; Joey Lombardi, the regional Excel talent manager with the Canadian Soccer Association; and Johnny McKinstry, head coach of the Rwandan national team, formerly of the Sierra Leone national team. Today we talk about player development, emerging trends, and performance potential based on analytics. And I think you're really going to enjoy this podcast. It's really informative. I learned a lot, and these gentlemen are all worth following, and their information is located at the end of the podcast, so make sure you stick with it till the end. Thanks for listening.
Johnny, you're based in you're coaching in Africa. So can you kind of walk us through how you go through and identify talent and some of the things that you face when you look at constructing a team in a culture and in a country that not many people, especially in the United States, really know about, and how you go about that, and what similarities that would draw towards picking a team back in the UK or in Ireland or anywhere else for that matter?
Yeah, I think there's various aspects to it. Firstly, obviously, with it being at international level, you get such little contact time with players that really getting the right group together is so important. And that's both on a sort of technical and tactical level, but also in terms of just even the personalities of the players, you know, their outlook on the game and their own personal drive. And that's not easy. For us in Rwanda, we've got players, a large proportion of the players are based domestically, which means the traditional, you know, attending matches, making scouting reports, looking to see how players might fit into your system, which isn't always easy because the club they're at may be playing a different system. Maybe the player plays a certain type of role for the club, but you might envisage something slightly different for them at a national team. And then it extends right through to then players who are playing abroad. So we have several players who are playing in some of the bigger leagues within Africa, in Kenya and Tanzania, and then also some playing up in Europe. And really, that again can be in-person scouting, in-person analysis, but it can also then be the use of a lot of the modern tools within the game. Obviously, there's several companies where I think we all know you can log on and download game and match statistics and data like that. And, you know, it's sort of a merging of all of these factors to try and put together a squad and a team, both who you think can mix well together, but also who are in form. And definitely, I think it's probably a lot easier as international coaches now than it would have been maybe 10 or 15 years ago when we didn't have so many of these tools. Now, one of my players who plays in Belgium, I can watch every game that he plays. I just need to go and download it off the system. So that's very handy. But definitely, it's, you know, it's a long process. And one of the big questions people always say is, you know, why do you not make changes very quickly? And the answer is that, you know, you've got to maybe, someone has to provide evidence over the course of 5, 6, 7 games that they're consistent and at the level that they can step up to the international game, because it's significantly different than the club game in terms of not only the time you get to spend with the players, but also just it's maybe more tactical, maybe not quite as high-paced a game as it is in some countries.
Jed, bring you into this. You're a tactical consultant for a national team, correct?
Yeah. So, no, currently doing tactical consultancy for Estonia, so Magnus Pearson.
Okay, so within the same vein that Johnny's just kind of laid out for us, with regards to having so little contact time with your players and building, whether it's a program or a direction for the coach to implement a player development theme or direction, how do you go about doing your job? And then we're gonna bring in you know, Kev on the club side at Cardiff City after that.
So a lot of my work is done as a presentation to the manager rather than to the players. So from my perspective, that gives me freedom to sort of explore all the tactical options. But what gets transferred to the players is maybe 10% of that information, largely because of the different understandings of the games, the different backgrounds they've got, but also because where they're at in their development. So if I went in with an idea of a high-pressing model against a team, that might not be something Estonia have done over the last 24 months. So, you know, we talked about management over time. I think Johnny mentioned there, it's very difficult to put something in place international level without a prior cultural understanding of any tactical strategy you want to employ. I wonder from Johnny's perspective, so I know from the European side, you get every single player's games on Instat or Y-Scout. Whether Johnny has the same access out, Johnny, do you have the same access out there to individual players?
Well, ultimately, for a small sample of our players, we do those players in the leagues covered by the systems. In the domestic sense, we're trying to address it on our own level. So we've recently brought on board full-time analysts to the team, to our international setup. But part of their role, the plan is for them to train sort of domestic people with each club within the Rwandan Premier League to try and make sure that we're getting all the games videoed and there's at least a base level of analysis going on. Now, that's not going to be at the sort of top end standard of the Y Scouts and Instats of the world, but it's definitely a beginning. But that is the challenge, because ultimately you can only get to one game a weekend sort of thing.
Do you get a lot of access to your players while they're at their clubs to go and talk to them, show them videos, give them a classroom session, as it were, on tactics?
Yeah, one of the things we try to do coming into each international camp is to send players out certain information ahead of time in terms of video clips. Now, most of the players have their smartphones, they have their tablets or their laptops. So our analyst team, you know, and myself will decide on what information we want the players to have ahead of time and also what information we want to hold back and give to them during the week of training camp. And so usually they'll come in with an idea of what we want from them coming into that game, whether that's reflection of their own performance in their previous games for the national team or whether it's looking forward to this specific game. They'll be given little bits that then helps feed into the process once they join the team.
So I think a lot of the good work done at international level is often through behaviour shaping from video footage of other players doing what you would like them to do in the upcoming game. But that's something we certainly do.
Absolutely. And it's even one of the things that we would tend to use that for as well is actually immediately prior to performance in terms of in the dressing room. You know, we give our analysts quite a big role in that we'll have agreed prior to games, you know, things that we want to show the players in terms of this is exactly what, you know, they'll have seen bits of it already during the week and the build up to the game. But again, those sort of flash reminders of, you know, 30 minutes, 40 minutes before they're going out, you know, when they're in the dressing room before they go out onto to their warm-ups, just little flashes, you know, those light bulb moments saying, look, we want you to do something like this in the first 10, 15 minutes of the game to try and have an impact. And it can be very, you know, it can have a big sort of influence on certain players.
Now, Kev, in the club side, what kind of similarities do you tie into this? I know you have more contact with players.
Yeah.
You have younger players that I know. Younger footballers, but obviously, you know, analytics and data and consistency over time and contact with these players plays a big part. Can you kind of walk us through that? And then Joey, go ahead and tag in when he's done about how you approach this and where you're at.
Yeah, I think, John, first of all, at club level, obviously, you get a lot of time to use analysis, video clips, etc. with the players. I think the first thing to say is that the players very much enjoy watching themselves play. I think that's one thing that I've noticed since working at, you know, youth level, first team level. All of our players have access to video clips from every game, so they'll go in and they'll watch their own clips and we'll provide feedback to them as well. Going off the back of the identification one, obviously at club level, it's very, very simple the way obviously we would look to identify players. Firstly, it'd be positional. So if we require a certain position. And then secondly, it would be based upon what is above and what is below, and then compare that player to what we've already got within the system, and judge them that way. In terms of the analysis, work closely with an analyst with the under 21 team at Cardiff City. So he provides me with a lot of data and statistics, both individual and collective. And then, a bit like Jeb was saying there, we all then decide on how much we use with the players. And I think in development football, in comparison to first team football, you don't tend to overdo it, because I think, especially if you're looking at the opposition, for example, you'll tend to focus more on yourselves as individuals and collectively as a team than you would on the opposition. We'll make our players aware of who they're coming up against, etc. But the focus is very much on us, improving our statistics week to week, and obviously on an individual basis as well.
And Joey, to bring you in, you know, you have a background in football analytics, and you're based in Toronto. So how was the attitude toward all these things that these gentlemen are talking about accepted there, and how do you implement these things?
It's quite interesting with us. I'm also the assistant coach with the U17 women's national team. So a big part of my role is I travel to each province and scout players and decide who's going to be our intake group for the U17 national team, which is our first age group team for the Canadian women's pathway. So we still use traditional scouting methods where we go out, we watch a player. If we like what we see, we have identification camps where we'll bring a big pool of players in and evaluate them in the environment. But also, too, in each province, we now have performance analysts who record every game. They code the games. We get individual clips on every player. So at any point throughout this process, I can easily pull up a player's clips and analyze their performance. Plus, we get data. And then with the data, we centralize everything into a depth chart. So I can start to compare players globally, positionally. If I need a left-footed left back, I can find that information all in my depth chart. So it's quite interesting how we've tied in the traditional scouting with analytics. So we kind of marry the two when we make a decision on a player. Along with that, too, we have physical data where we measure speed, endurance, power, which is interesting information. But we got to be careful with the physical data, too, when you're dealing with youth players, because if they've not gone for their growth spurt, the data could be kind of unreliable at that point. So we take that in consideration when we're looking at youth players.
So that's something I want to definitely hit on, is misleading data. And I know here in the States, we have a big problem. As I'm a coach myself, and a lot of people love to use the distance covered as a metric for quality play. And I'm not sure that that's reflected in the experience that you gentlemen have. But it's very dangerous to measure how far or how much a player or team runs collectively. This is just an example I'm using. We can take another direction. But to say that this is a good performance, you know, the biggest example would be during the World Cup. The U.S. ran more than they probably should have, but people are saying, well, they're working really hard. But I saw it as, well, they're chasing a lot and they're being drawn out and whatnot. How often do you Johnny, we'll start with you. How often do you see data misrepresented or misleading? And how do you make decisions to just disregard certain bits of data with regards to scouting reports or player analysis?
Yeah, I think it's important to know. It's sort of what comes first, the chicken or the egg. You know, I sort of go in when I talk to my analysts of the sort of things, the information I want to try and pull out of the game. But equally, you don't want those preconceived ideas to overly influence the data. You just want the sort of the important stuff. You know, we call them the key performance indicators and stuff. And I've worked with analysts in the past and who've went on and done very, very well for themselves in the game. But I remember in the early days, they were bringing me things like, you know, obviously possession was a big thing and pass completion rates. Now, for me personally, pass completion is a statistic that I don't really ever look at. You know, people would come to me and say, oh, you know, this player had 97 or 98% pass completion. And I'm like, well, that's okay, but we need more depth to that. You know, I want to know more about, say, key passes completed, because that might only be 60% completion rate. But at the same time, if you're completing 60% of your key passes, that's actually quite good. Now, it doesn't look nice on a graph. You know, 98, 97% looks nice on a graph, but is it useful? And I know what you mentioned about the distance covered. You know, I've been to one or two Premier League clubs over the years who that was the be-all and end-all. And I remember thinking, well, some of the very top players, wouldn't have made it if that was the thing that they were being judged on and critiqued on. You know, it's got to be about effectiveness, and that's going to be different from team to team. You know, what I consider effective for me might not be the same as what Kevin considers effective for his Cardiff team. I think the best example the world knows this season is the Leicester Cities of the world, or the Atletico Madrid. You know, there, what they're looking for from their statistics is going to be significantly different maybe than what a Barcelona or a Bayern Munich are looking for from their data. So it really is about tailoring it to the strengths and weaknesses of your players as well.
Jed, do you have any follow-up for that?
Just mentioning on what I would use statistics for and data like that, often it's around the playing style objectives and taking something like pass completion on, which Johnny mentioned there. I mean, that can be detrimental when you're looking at something like you want to look at risk taken in a certain area of the field. And if you're focusing too much on something like pass completion, particularly as a message to players, that can be detrimental to your playing style and your objectives, the things that you want to work on. And one of these things that a lot of people are looking at now is expected goals. And that's seen as sort of the be-all, end-all, the top single encompassing piece of data that looks at who should have won the game. Well, even that doesn't consider things like individual quality of players, defensive pressure, fatigue, goalkeeper positioning. And I think with all these pieces of data, there's always something you miss out on when you're trying to collect it and quantify the game. For me, I try and stay away from statistics unless I've got a piece of subjective information I want to quantify. So I wouldn't go and quantify something and then go and build a message from that. And the best example I've seen in the industry is someone trying to quantify the game is what Prozone are doing. Paul Power at Prozone does try and quantify things right down to the individual component of what's happening in that moment of the game. But even there, you're missing out on something at all times.
So this is the type of thing that I see a lot in other sports. And Kev, I'm going to shoot this your way, and Joe your way as well. We talk about getting this misrepresentation of data, but also there's intangibles that there are no metrics for, there are no data sets for, and even if you had them, what would you do with them? And are you seeing at Cardiff or anywhere else for that matter, and a clash between traditional, I don't want to say gut feeling, but that's kind of the only word I can come up with, versus data sets that are telling a story or trying to construct something that you really can't put your thumb on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense, John. I think just going off the back of what Johnny was talking about with the possession and the pass completion, etc., it completely makes sense to me. I think the game is about efficiency. And I think Leicester, like Johnny mentioned, and Atletico Madrid and the likes of these teams are proving that at the moment. You know, they're some of the most successful teams in the world, and they're the most efficient. So linking into that, I mean, you will have a gut feeling of how you've played, of course, from standing there watching the team play, also watching it back on DVD, and then you'll get the stats, and sometimes the stats will match up to what you think. And sometimes they might be slightly off the mark. So everything's got to be put into context. In terms of going back to the efficiency point and Johnny's point regarding Leicester and Atletico Madrid, is that a stat I look for a lot and we look at is the passes per shot. So I know that Leicester in the Premier League this season, I think, had the lowest... one of the lowest amount of passes per shot on record. So obviously that's the amount of passes required on average to attain a shot on goal. Because as you can see, the game's constantly evolving, and obviously there was a number of years where, you know, it was about having 60, 70% possession, and a lot of coaches and a lot of teams still want that, of course, and I can understand why, because you have control of the game, but ultimately it's about what you do with the possession that you have. So again, off the pass completion one, you would want to know how many passes are forwards, how many passes are actually hurting the opposition, you know, how many passes are in the opposition's half, or, you know, or successful passes even in the final third close to the opposition's goal, which again are going to be more effective passes. rather than your own half. And then we look a lot at the ratio between final third entries and penalty area entries. So how many times are you getting in the final third? And then off the back of that, what's the percentage of the percentage of times you're getting into the penalty area? The more times you get in the penalty area, of course, once you're in the final third, the more chance you've got of scoring goals. So that's what we would look at. But I think you should never go off the back of your instinct and your gut feeling about a performance or a game that you watch with your own eyes now.
Yeah, I just want to add, Kev, can I add something here? I don't know if
Yep, no problem.
Yeah, I just want to add that, you know, youth level statistics, so certainly with something like ball possession. So I know a certain club or a number of clubs actually would use statistics to build about development tools. So one of them might be, we want 70% of our possession in the opposition half, with the idea that we're trying to create attacking players who play within the opposition block. And then within there, they'll have a number of rules or statistical guides to help them create that scenario as often as possible. One of them might be, you know, the Pep Guardiola book. I think it outlines something like 15 passes before you get the opposition. I can't remember what the stat is now. But that might be something you might want to incorporate to miss out on the counter-attack, but to force the opposition into a low block and work on that scenario as a development tool. Do you do a lot of that with the under-21s, or is it under-21 level? Is that more in line with the first team performances?
Yeah, obviously we try, the way we play will link into how the first team play. And I think that's a number of clubs now. I think first team would link into under 21 level. In terms of possession, Jed, I've still got a thing about that because, like I say, I'm a believer that it's about what you do when you've got the ball. I think that's proven by the teams that can win games with 30% possession. I think you have... Obviously, at the top level, it's about finding a way to win, whether you try and do it with 70% possession or 30% possession or whatever, 50% possession. It's about finding a way to win. I think with teams defending, or more teams defending deeper nowadays, I think the reaction to the transition and realising that's a great opportunity on regaining possession to go and score quickly is something that has to be noted as well, because, you know, you look at... I mean, I was watching Tottenham the other day. I think they were playing Stoke on Sky, and absolutely superb. I mean, one of the goals, I think they won it in and around the final third. I think it was two passes, and it's in the back of Stoke's net. So I think teams are looking to counter quickly, and not just from deep. I think, again, when people talk about counter-attacks, people think from deep positions. I think the game's becoming a more counter-attacking game now from all over the pitch, wherever you win the ball, because teams are very, very happy now and content to get back into, you know, a solid defensive shape in their own half and be difficult to break down. So the quicker, and I think the less passes you use once you win the ball in order to try and score the goal, the better.
So, and Joey, you see this, we're going to, you know, these points, but also going back to these misrepresentation of data and going on that theme again in the women's game. How do you relate that, and what kinds of things and trends are you seeing in your analysis through the provinces in Canada, and how you relate that information and apply it to your coaching?
So, yeah, I agree with, like, what Kevin was saying about the efficiency measurements. We do a lot of stuff with that. So what we'll do is we'll measure how many times we get in between the opposition's back four and midfield lines and face forward. And we'll also measure how many times we get in behind their back four. And then from those areas, did we go from in between the in behind the back line? Did we create a final act, a shot or cross? Did we retain possession, or did we lose the ball from those areas? And then we measure that also even further in terms of who created that entry into those areas and who received that. So you start to get partnerships. So you can look at a cross-reference table and start to see who created those type of events for our team, and you can start to get some sort of measurements on who's linking up well and who's partnering well. So over time, once you get trend data, you can start to see which key partnerships would be most effective for our team, which is kind of cool. So you start to get a bit of tactical profiling. Then we even break it down further to, did we get in between or in behind the opposition's back four through transition, or was it more from build-up? And so we would actually measure the time in possession that it took us to actually get to those areas. So we can start to see trends in that and that sort of thing in terms of tactical profiling. And we'll do the same for our opposition team. So we can start to get a bit of a profile developed just from analytics as to their playing style.
Joey, is that something used from a development perspective or the perspective where you want to win games? So in your experiences, has the team that's won games played between lines the most? And that's a very simplistic way of looking at it, but is that something you concluded?
It is. So we call it out advanced platforms. So if an opposition team out advanced platforms the other team, I've not seen any games where the team that had less AVPs won the match. Generally, it correlates to a winning performance.
So that's facing forward in between lines, right?
Facing forward in between the back four midfield line or in behind the back line. Yep. So it does correlate with winning and results. And again, like I said, we measure how they get there through build up or transition. So it's been quite cool. The other area too is when you start to look at physical data, we're using GPS units and heart rate, and it's been quite cool. So we've gone to the other element where we're not just measuring physical performance, but we're also using it for wellness to see how much loading we're putting on the players. Does the player need recovery time? We also measure weight loss post training, so we can get an indicator how much we've taxed the players and. You know, that's obviously going to influence the next practice and the next day of training, or if we have to give them a recovery day. Measuring sleep patterns, which has been quite cool. So there's quite a lot of things going on the physical side. And to build on what we talked about earlier about distance covered, we don't really look at distance covered. It's more high-intensity actions. So how many high-intensity actions did a player make? And then when you start to watch the game over again, you can start to see how purposeful those actions were. Were they creating space in attack? Were they pressing at the right time? Recovery runs in transition. So we start to look at that stuff too when we look at the overall performance. But in the end, the video is the best tool. You know, what you see in the video, a player could have poor data, but gets two shots on goal and scores. So, you know, the video is always the key. In the end.
Okay, so one of the things that I've been hearing a lot in coaching circles in North America is something called performance potential. And Johnny, I'm going to have you tackle this question first. And how people are defining it is not so much how good a player is now, but how good a player could be or could become based on these KPIs, these key performance indicators. Is there time or is there relevance in that with a national team position coaching job? Is there time for actually base assessment on performance potential as a theme?
Well, I would argue potentially not even just at the international level, but just at the professional level, full stop. It's difficult. You know, all of us working at the top end of the game, you know, you're based on wins. You know, it needs to be what's happening right now. We all would love to be in a situation like sort of the long-standing managers, the likes of the Sir Alex Fergusons, the likes of the Arsene Wengers, who have that sort of stability and support level that allows us to look at player potential and say, okay, well, in the next 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, this player is going to develop into this. And we know that if we give them, you know, a certain amount of access to the first team and training or whatever it happens to be, that it'll help guide them towards that. But the nature of the game nowadays is so sort of cut and thrust that, you know, if you lose three games, then all of a sudden you're on very uneven ground. So at international level, it is very difficult in terms of every game is pressurized, and even more so actually here in Africa, because whereas up in Europe and maybe in North America, you've got the very clear distinction between a friendly international and a competitive qualifier. In Africa, the distinction isn't there anywhere near as clearly. If we lose a friendly international and then were to win a competitive international, well, people would be like, oh, well, 50-50. As opposed to friendlies are there to help you win the competitive game. So it is difficult. Ideally, we all want to, you know, bring those young players through. And I think, you know, even my own record at international level, I've always looked to put players in when I can to help sort of breed that potential, because I know, look, in the next few years, but definitely at the top end of the game, it's very, very difficult. It's about the here and now, because like I said, if you lose three games on the bounce, doesn't matter what league you're in, you're in trouble.
Jed or Kev or Joe, you want to add into that, this idea of performance potential being relevant or not relevant? I know for Kev it might be more of a theme because you are working with the younger players. Jed, as you do consulting work, it might be not relevant at all. And Joey, you are working with younger players, so this is something that over time you do chart. So let's start with Jed. You go ahead and take this one first.
Well, I've worked with younger players before, actually out in Canada, and I'm quite cautious of this sort of thing, of profiling players around that. But I think a lot of the youth development work that I would do would be following along the lines of trying to create an identity that's unique for each player. And I'm very cautious to use this sort of stuff with young players, so it's not something I'm particularly familiar with. But I would say that if you're going to profile a certain position around certain data, I'd be very cautious of that in terms of not allowing individual interpretations of that position and creating unique identities out of each player. So that's my take on that.
Kev?
Yeah, for me, obviously, I've obviously been fortunate enough to work in development football now, and I've got a good amount of experience within that, and I've seen obviously young players come through and play at the highest level. So I think for me it's pretty straightforward. I think it's about good coaching. It's about obviously making sure that player is in a good environment where he's able to flourish, you know, and then an ongoing review, really, of that player's individual performance over time. You know, constantly reviewing it, working with him on the areas which he needs to improve, as well as making sure that they focus on the strengths. I think one thing to say in terms of developing young players is that as much as the focus a lot of the time is on an action plan and people wanting to document about areas in which they need to improve, I'm a big believer, and I speak to the young players about this, is that everybody has their own strengths as a player, but you can't be brilliant at everything. I mean, there's only certain players in the world that are very, very good at most things, but you can't be brilliant at everything. So you have to find your own, I think, eventual, you know, personal playing brand, if you like, even as a young player. And then the coach needs to be aware of maybe what that young player's strengths are and make sure that then them strengths are maximised to its best effect, because the better they make their strengths, probably the more likely they are to make an impact later down the line. Obviously, you can be aware of what you still need to work on, of course, and continue working with that in the background. But being aware of your strengths and making them better is massive. So in terms of young player development, good coaching within the right environment, where they're allowed to, you know, flourish, and then, like I say, an ongoing review really of their individual performance.
And Joey, how do you use this performance potential theme in or do you use it at all?
Well, we have positional profiles, so like what the ideal fullback would be like, and it's a list of competencies across different themes that we're looking for. And we use mainly subjective methods when we measure competencies. So we'll do four times a year, basically individual performance plans, IPPs, which provides feedback on performance across the 3-4 months that we've been measuring them. And along with that, we do throw in performance data, but the performance data is more as a backup. It just gives you an indicator that maybe your subjective eye didn't provide. So we just use it as a backup, as a developmental tool, and not so much as a pure indicator whether a player should be moving up the system or stay where they are or move below the system. So we don't really use it for that. It's more just as a backup, as a developmental tool. And the key thing too is we have individual footage that we provide to back up the reports. So we'll sit with the player, review the feedback, and also provide them with some video clips of themselves and best practice to help aid them as they move forward in their pathway. So yeah, we mix the two, but again, we like Kevin was saying, it's about the daily training environment, providing them with the feedback that they need, so when they go out on the pitch, they have some objectives to work on, and we really aim at providing that information for them.
So let's take this conversation to more of the player development route without the analytics, if we can a bit. We're looking at different types of players, and in a new age of football, in my opinion, I think you're seeing, if you listen to the podcast with Jamie Carragher, we see more. He said everyone wants to be the number 10, no one wants to be number 9, and we have these ball playing center backs, and certain things are starting to evolve, and I think we expect our players to be more complete than in years past. What type of emerging skill sets are we looking for in players? Johnny, go ahead and take this one first.
I think intelligence, is the thing we've always been looking for. Players who can think, it's not news to anybody that the game's no longer that sort of dictatorial, you must play here, you must do this. I know we compare players greatly nowadays, and analytics brings that up. It's sort of like we cross-compare players. It's this number six is playing this many passes over this range, et cetera, and we look at them, who should we sign, who should we call up? But at the end of the day, I think we mentioned a couple of teams earlier are playing in a very different style to what people 2 or 3 years ago would have said was good. It was like, well, Barcelona's the way to win games. Those are the type of players that we want. And now all of a sudden the Atletico Madrids and the Leicesters are being very successful. People a couple of years ago wouldn't have told you a Jamie Vardy might have been so successful. It's like, oh, he's fast and he hits the shot early. Maybe he needs to have more skills to his game, but at the same time, he reads the game very well. He gets into the good positions, and he's one of the top goal scorers in the league. And intelligence is one of those things. It's difficult to develop. It's not just out on the training pitch. It is, education through various different means. Is it players watching some video? Is it players being guided through something on the computer, in the classroom, out on the pitch? And it's about hitting all those different learning styles. And when you get those type of players, you can almost mold a team around them. For me as a coach, I'm quite open. I know how I want to play football, but at the same time, if you find a player who you can read his intelligence level of reading the game, it's sort of like, okay, well, maybe we can shape our strategy to get to maximize your potential. So, you sort of asked at the beginning, what skills are the modern players developing? But it really is that ability to read the game. And, obviously all the basic ones are there, the ability to control, the ability to move the ball, the ability to, hit those passes. That's never going to change in the game. But somebody who, lives one or two steps ahead, and the very best players live 3 or 4 steps ahead, they're seeing the game develop. And really, the way we develop young players to read the game and have a tactical insight, even at a young age, is becoming more and more important, I feel.
And Kev or Jed, do you have a follow-up for that? I know emerging skill sets is, yeah. And what I mean by this is literally, you're expecting, as Johnny just said, you're expecting players to, play a certain mold. But I think sometimes, in the States, we see this so much with, players trying to specialize so early in one thing because they see something years ahead, on TV. They don't really, they only specialize on one or two things. Kev, what do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting just listening, really. First of all, obviously to Johnny's points and Jed's and everyone's and Joey's. And I think, for me, the technical side will always be hugely important. I think certainly to play at the highest level, I think to be able to deal with the ball, first touch, ability to pass it well, run with the ball well, particularly nowadays as well, very, very important. So, a high range or, a wide range of technical skills is going to be important, but also technical skills at speed, because of the way how fast the game is nowadays. You only have to look at the top level, the speed of the game, being able to take the ball and be comfortable with the ball, both in tight areas when bodies are around you, and also to take the ball when everything's moving quickly around you, is going to be important. My second point is around tactical flexibility. I believe in the Premier League this season, I mean, there were teams that have played 3, 4, even 5 different formations this season. So as a young player developing, and I know that a lot of clubs have to document now their preferred playing system as well as their style. But I'm a big believer that young players have to learn to play within different formations. And I think that's a big one moving forward. You know, the ability to understand how to play in a back four as well as a back three. The ability to play in a, you know, a flat four in midfield as well as within a diamond. And the list goes on, if you like. But so the high-level technical skills, tactical flexibility and understanding, and that goes into Johnny's point of game intelligence that would link into that.
It's good. I'm similar to these, to Kevin and Johnny, in terms of what we look at. A big one for us is vision and awareness, the player's ability to read the game and their overall intelligence. Another thing, too, is proactive play. Like, for example, when you're defending, do they defend with attack in mind? So not just thinking about the defensive action, but the actual regain leads to another action and being proactive and thinking one step ahead. Those are key things that we look at and train to build the technical habits of each individual as they go through their development. It's a big piece for us.
I just want to touch on a few things mentioned there by each of you. So something that was mentioned about specialization of positions or developing number 10s or ball player centre-backs. That's something I've spoken to first team managers with before, and a few of them have said, we've got an 18-year-old lad coming through, he's a number 10, he's unbelievable, but there's no way we can put him in the first team in that role. And I think that's something certainly to be thinking about as you're developing young players, is what, you know, okay, you're developing this type of player, is he A, appropriate for your first team, and B, appropriate for any team in professional football? And you know, there's players at a local academy near me who have used to have and still do to a certain extent a high ball possession philosophy, and their centre backs are all ball playing centre backs. A lot of them are quite small and skillful on the ball, and you know, they've been released by their, you know, category one under 21s professional football academy, and then not being able to find semi professional clubs in the Welsh Premier League. I mean, you know, there's that problem there. And I think with a first team manager, I mean, you want to look at a young lad coming through and know his strengths and know the identity of that player. You look at most top level players, there's three or four strengths you could name for any top professional, whether that's Cristiano Ronaldo or Messi. They know their strengths, and more importantly, they're able to showcase them. So I'd be looking at players who are able to move on a field. And by that, I mean, be able to find the scenarios to help bring about their strengths. So that might be that you're a number nine that's very good at dropping in between lines, and you know your strength is a 1v1 with defender behind scenario. So for that, you might have good speed, good agility, good receiving, and so on. And if you can bring about that scenario as often as possible, you're going to look like a fantastic individual with individual superiority over your opponent. And that's something I look at, especially with young players, is can they understand the game through that lens?
That's actually one of the best ways I've ever heard someone say it. Is here in the States, we've got this problem where we develop these players and we expect so much out of them, and that's okay. But we also we have a generation after generation, and Joe, you can maybe tie into this with a North American perspective, and it may be the same everywhere, where we develop what we call jacks of all trades, masters of none, where we you know, they flirt with certain areas of their competencies, but then they never, and I don't want to use the word specialized, but they never get a firm foundation playing one way or the other, or they just don't get enough, I guess, application integration in some of these methods. And I think so much of what we expect of young players, there's not enough time. And I've used this analogy before, where so many young coaches or coaches of young players, rather, in a microwave society instead of a crock pot one. We should maybe let things stand in there over time instead of just imagine we can, you know, push a button and instantly everything's better or produced. That's where I was going to end up with. But go ahead and take that point, because I think you're going to echo some sentiments that I have anyway as an American.
Absolutely. Like, and here in Canada, like, each club plays differently. Like, you'll club A versus club B will have a completely different playing style. And when each club is playing a different style, when you bring them into a national team system, you're trying to adopt a common behavior and a common way of playing the game. And it takes time. Where I know, for example, we used to go to Spain with our youth teams. And regardless if we played Espanyol or if we played Barcelona, the teams played exactly the same way, always building out of the back, linking through midfield, dynamic forwards who were very technical, who had pace. So the playing style was common among all clubs that we played, even when we played some second division teams, Girona and a few other clubs. So I found that really interesting. Where here in Canada, like I said earlier, some clubs will play out of the back, some won't. Now through changes in our pathway, we have high performance leagues where there's actually a common playing style among all clubs in these leagues at the youth level. And that's changing the landscape in Canada. So now you're starting to see, you know, a general thing would be center backs who can be comfortable in possession. So not only are they strong defensively, but also they're great in the buildup, and they got the technical ability to progress play from the back.
So sorry, you see more. Yes. Can I ask a quick question just on that point there? You're talking about clubs having different identities, and over here we have academies that have different philosophies. So Liverpool will produce one sort of player, and Man United will produce another based on their playing styles. Do you see any benefit in one club having a possession philosophy and one that works more on the defensive one because of the type of players they get? They aren't as strong as the opposition. In the northwest of England, you'll have clubs that have weaker players throughout because of their recruitment capabilities. Do you see any problem in teams having different playing styles, or do you want to have one across the board?
I think when you're looking at a national way of playing, I think a common way is fine. How they go about it, whether it's 3-5-2, 4-3-3, the actual structure of it, I don't see that being a problem. Actually, I think that's a good thing because players learn to be tactically flexible, and you know, you have a different type of player coming through, and I think that's great to have a variety in some sense, and players with different experiences, because that all contributes to your overall group. But I think when you look at a national way of playing, it has to be similar at least. Like, you know, I mean, if some teams are playing a direct play and some teams are playing out from the back, and then you as a national coach are trying to develop a playing style from the back, it's going to take a longer time. Whereas if they've been doing that at the youth development stage for a while, it's not so difficult, and you can start to progress things to another standard. So I do think there's benefits. Again, I also look at it from the other realm. Tactical flexibility in the modern game is a key thing. So you don't want robotic players. You want players who can think and read the game and be tactically flexible to different situations, which you're going to come across, you know, at the international level. So, you know, there is benefits. But I do think when you look at the bigger picture overall, I think a national way of playing is a key feature.
I guess the problem I have with getting my head around that is this idea that when you're developing a first team playing style, it's often around who your top two or three players are, or whatever it might be. And so often, you know, that changes every 5, 6, 7 years. So I understand the benefits of having one philosophy for the country and everyone's playing the same way. But, you know, your philosophy is who the 11 players are. If you're successful, it's catered around who your players are currently. And that, you know, that changes based on the cultural upbringing of players, you know, what they've been exposed to. There's so much that contributes to that rather than just this is the type of training methods we use, this is the type of playing style we use. So it's just something that I'm, you know, something I've been considering and thinking about over the last few years, especially with the English, you know, the English FA bringing out their identity, their DNA.
It's actually a good point. Like, a lot of factors when you design your playing model, like the cultural aspect, the type of player. You know, North American players traditionally are very athletic. You know, I mean, you look at it, you think of an American player, like you think of the power aspect. They can, you know, defend well. They're quick in transition. So this type of profile has, you know, an effect on how you design your playing model, for sure. So you're right, Jed. There's a lot of factors involved. And I think it needs to be flexible, too, when you design a playing model.
Yeah, if I can just come in on that, the national thing is something that I get approached by over here quite a lot, and actually here, just as culturally, you know, a national coach can probably be a little bit more dictatorial towards the clubs and how they play. But it's one of the things I get asked is like, well, could you not almost ask club teams and academies to develop in a certain fashion? And the answer I always say is, you know, it's almost an impossible thing to do long term, because you've got to remember clubs in their essence are businesses, and they will, and in the modern game at the very top level, like in some of the big leagues in Europe, they'll do what's best for them. You know, there's no way you could tell me that Manchester United or Arsenal or Barcelona or Bayern Munich are really overly interested in the national interest of the game. They're interested in theirs. So it's one of those those things that is, you know, yes, it would be great in this sort of utopian, this is the way England play, this is the way Spain play, et cetera, et cetera. But I sort of get the feeling, you know, on my side of it at national team level, like I would love that to be the case. I would love all of the academies to play in the way that I think the game's going to develop and us as an association think the game's going to develop over the next 10, 15, 20 years. I just sort of wonder, we're spending so much time on it. And I always ask myself, is something realistic? You know, and I don't know how realistic it is. And even you look at, everyone talks about the Spanish model, obviously, and have done, and how successful it's been. But even then, you know, Spain themselves would tell you that they've got issues and challenges. You know, Spain are not developing centre forwards. You look at Barcelona and Real Madrid, who are obviously their flagship teams of recent years, now Atletico coming into it. But you know, almost all of the strikers they bring in are from South America because they realize that's not something their system is developing. So, you know, a national style, I just think it's very, very difficult to maintain. It's very difficult to maintain that sort of national strategy moving forward long term, because clubs ultimately, with the money involved in the game nowadays, are out for their own personal interests. I think you see that even with the club v country issues at international level, you know, do players get released and all of that. So, you know, and even you now start seeing as well, even at academy level, the top clubs, you know, from 16 upwards are signing players from wherever they can. It's, can we bring in the best players from wherever they are and we'll develop them for what we think our club needs as opposed to what the country needs? And, you know, it's a bit of a cynical way of looking at it. But again, it's, you know, how do you change that? Because even if you have a national program, if, you know, Manchester United or Swansea or Cardiff City or whoever decide that the national program isn't in line with what they believe is best for their club, well, then they're just not going to adhere to it.
Right. I think the next topic I was going to bring up, but for the sake of everyone's morning, we're going to save it for part two, would be the barriers that everyone's facing with regards to the player development or the one thing that they're the biggest barrier they see day to day. So we'll do that, and then we're going to wrap up here. And what I want to do is I want you know, everyone to tell people where they can find you, what you're currently working on, and then when we do part two, we'll have to carry this conversation further. So, Johnny, since you just wrapped up here, what's the one barrier that you face with your Rwanda national team with regards to whether it's talent identification, whether it's just something general that you'd like to, you know, kind of touch on, and then where can people find you?
I think it's ultimately contact time, regardless of whether, you know, that's exacerbated for me at international level because they're not my players per se, they're other people's. But, you know, even, you know, down to youth academy level and developing young players, it's that contact time. And it's not necessarily out on the pitch contact time. It's just the whole sphere of people being focused on something. Are young players really thinking about the game as much? You know, I think all of us know what it was like when we were younger to go out and play football for 7, 8, 9 hours, and you'd come home and your parents had asked you where you've been all day. You were just out playing, and it was that contact with the game. And I just don't think young players, and at my level international players, use that contact time. It is difficult. In terms of where I'm at, obviously, you know, out here for hopefully the next couple of years with the Rwanda national team, people can find me on Twitter at Johnny McKinstry, or log onto the website at johnnymckinstry.com. And yeah, you know, always interested in having these type of discussions, whether it's through, you know, an organized platform like this or people just want to interact on a one-on-one basis. You know, I'm more than open to that.
And Kev, where can people find you? Or yeah, Kev, go ahead and you go, and then Jed will get you on, and Joey.
Yeah, I mean, in answer to your first question, I think there's one thing. Obviously, you can look at barriers, and of course, I'm involved, obviously, at, you know, a professional football club working at youth level. So I think the aim is always to try and produce players that are good enough to obviously go and play in your first team, and that's what we try and do. So rather than looking at necessarily the barriers, we look at the opportunities really for the young players, and obviously our job as coaches is to work with the young players and to continue developing them over the course of time and hope that eventually they're good enough to go on and play at first team level. So we look at the opportunities rather than barriers, really. But no, thanks for obviously having me on, and it's been good to chat to all of you and get to hear about your thoughts on the game and different areas surrounding the game. In terms of where people can find, well, obviously I'm working at Cardiff City at this moment in time, working with the under-21s, something that I've done now for a period of time. Been at Cardiff 3 years in total, before that Exeter City and previous to that Derby County. I'm on Twitter, which is obviously at KevNicholson1. So people can find me there and interact with me there. So yeah, but thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure to obviously talk to you and talk to all of you.
And Jed?
With regards to barriers, I think one of the things that under 21 managers or any youth team or national team coach would have is just constant changing of squad, either through injury or through a player being promoted to the first team or going out on loan. And I think the best example, best case study I've seen of someone turning this into an opportunity is Mick Beale up at Liverpool. So this season, I think they've sent 80% of their under 21 squad has gone out on loan and then come back and then gone out on loan. And looking at how he's managed that tactically, individual developments and things like that, that's something well worth looking into and spending your time on. There is stuff available online about that. So that's something, you know, that I've taken good interest into this year, Mick Beale at Liverpool. And in terms of where people can find me, well, I'm forever active on Twitter, whether it's 4 a.m. or 9 a.m. So you'll be able to find me on Twitter, and the current project I'm working on, I guess, is still, for those who are probably getting annoyed about when it's not out, but the Bielsa book, which should be out this summer. I've now formatted it, I've now got the forward in from the person I've been asking the forward to come into, and all the processes have been followed up, so this summer.
Joey?
I think our biggest barrier is the size of our country. Like, for me, for example, to go scout a player in BC, I need to fly 5 hours, deal with a time zone difference of 3 hours, and just the overall geography of Canada and the size of the country is the biggest barrier and biggest challenge. Where in other countries they could drive 4 hours from top to bottom. So that's the challenges we face in a big country like Canada. But we're doing the best with the resources that we have to kind of minimize that barrier and make sure that we can support all provinces with staff and provide proper scouting and identification opportunities. In terms of me, myself, currently working towards the Under-17 Women's World Cup. We got the draw coming up end of the month for Jordan, so excited about that. Just getting ready for all possible types of opposition and getting our team ready for that event. For anybody who wants to reach me, you can reach me via Twitter at JoeyLombardi3. Also, anybody who maybe wants to individualize any messages, I can be reached via email at JoeyLombardi@CanadaSoccer.com. And thanks, everybody. It's been great just chatting with you guys, and very open to doing this again.
All right. Well, this has been another episode of the Lob Podcast for These Football Times. I want to thank all the guests. I'm John Townsend. You can find me, JON_Townsend, TOWNSEND 3 on Twitter. Like Jed, I'm on there all the time. And thanks to these gentlemen for their time, and we will chat with you soon. Take care.